In 1979, the body of a woman is found on or under a porch in North Camden, New Jersey. Years later, her skull is found in another residence. Despite these shocking finds, little information is shared about her. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
This week, we are joined by Shay Mack.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, there are some stories that we've shared that have been frustrating to work on due to lack of information, and I'm starting off by saying this is one of them.
I saw your Facebook post this week.
Yeah,
there's not much information.
No, there isn't.
I will say I got some spoilers for this one. I won't talk about them yet, but they're a little bone-chilling.
Well, yeah, so...
I mean, all of these cases are. But, like, this one seems... The information you have is particularly gruesome.
It is. I mean, that was, like, the distilled main facts of it. And those are really kind of, I think, most of the story.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, we think that telling these stories, the stories where there isn't a lot of information, is important specifically because there isn't a lot of information.
Right.
And we're just really hoping that this sort of helps further interest and further attention on them.
Right, because there, by the looks of things, there should have been a lot more information.
Yeah, so what this episode is going to be about is about an unidentified woman who was found in North Camden, New Jersey. And so even though she's in the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System database, thank goodness at least, there's not much about her story. And so this is going to be a little bit about why there isn't much about her story, kind of like the ecosystem and kind of things that were happening. We did reach out for case file information about her, and we were told they didn't have anything on her case. So
yeah, you were saying there was like not even a newspaper article.
There are a very few small articles about her, but it was really weird to like come across like, oh, there's no file on her, but like she has a nameless profile. So
how'd you get one without the other?
Exactly. Like, so, but okay. We did not get any information.
Okay.
So little news coverage. And if you've been listening to us for a while, you know, this is likely deeply connected to the fact that she's a Black woman and that also she was thought to have been homeless, which we'll talk a little bit more about. But we just talked about another unidentified Black woman who may have, in my estimation, been unhoused and how that detail plays a role in unidentified persons cases. So I encourage you to go and listen to that one as well. But for this one, we also have to know a little bit about where it took place to kind of understand what was happening at the time. And so the other night at dinner, I sat my family down and I was like, let's have a history lesson about North Camden, New Jersey. And my kid was like, I didn't sign up for this. And I was like,
did we just sign up for this?
You just signed up for it. Yes. Okay. So the setting for this is North Camden, New Jersey. And I feel like some of our listeners from New Jersey, which is like actually quite a huge pocket of listeners, like thank you, New Jersey, are going to be like, oh, that makes sense. But for everyone else, North Camden is an independent district of Camden, New Jersey. And to make a poetry connection here, Camden is where Walt Whitman wrote Leaves of Grass. And much of Camden's history was as a successful and booming city. We're talking shipyards and manufacturing jobs primarily. And the city was largely populated by white Europeans from both eastern and western sides of that continent. With World War II, Camden is the site of the world's largest shipyard, and with all those available jobs, the population demographics start to shift. There's a growing population of African Americans who take advantage of those opportunities and settle in Camden. Now, to be clear, I am giving a very reductive and quick history of Camden. I'm not a Camden historian, but basically, like a lot of other northern cities, Camden was heavily segregated, and eventually, with the rise of the automobile industry and development of suburbs, white flight happens. And then, with shifting markets, industries start to close, companies decentralized, they pull out of Camden, and so Camden goes from a booming town to one with a collapsing economy. Unemployment rises, housing becomes more precarious, people who can leave do, and all of this means that there's a less prosperous tax base, so city budgets shrink, and when those start to shrink, law enforcement gets slashed in a lot of communities. So with those who can leave leaving, there are so many city residents, particularly those in North Camden, who form community groups trying to enact change for a city that they loved and the place that they raised their families. They've been forced to watch their neighborhoods decline. Now, most people would say that the decline started in the 1980s, but in North Camden, at least, you see these community groups in the 1970s as well. They're hosting meetings, they're going to meetings with the mayor, they're meeting with Public Works, trying to get change in their neighborhoods. And what they're specifically asking for is the rehabilitation of housing in North Camden, more recreation opportunities and facilities for their children, and better police services. Even then in the 1970s, they can see that more is being invested in other areas of the city and that leaves their neighborhoods neglected. In 1979, the president of one of the neighborhood groups cited that the city only proposed to spend $275,000 on their neighborhood, and he wanted that figure closer to $1.1 million in the next fiscal year. Part of this ask was to take care of abandoned properties in North Camden. At the time, it was estimated that a third, or about 2,000 residences, were abandoned. In particular, they put forth a demand to deal with abandoned houses on Grant Street in the 500, 600, and 700 blocks. And one of the reasons these community groups are so heavily focused on abandoned homes in North Camden is because they are believed to be contributing to crime in their neighborhoods. They're concerned that drug deals and other crimes are happening in those abandoned residences.
I feel like we see these kind of towns like sprinkled across the United States.
So yeah, we're from New York, and so I kind of think like Buffalo and Syracuse are probably similar to this. And so What we're not saying is like that the crime is happening in these neighborhoods because these are now primarily these like segregated neighborhoods like of, you know, people of color. But what is happening is those crime rates are increasing because basically the city has abandoned those neighborhoods.
There's just less funding and a lot more of like you were saying, like these abandoned houses and places where people could get into trouble if they wanted to.
Yeah. So like, you know, people are moving out and that just puts so much stress on the like people who live there. And So these community groups are rising up and they're trying to say like, we love our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And you can actually even see this now in Camden and it's like contemporary former North Camden specifically, where you have like people who are desperately trying to keep their own houses up, like they're like, you know, like painting and putting out like plants and it's like gorgeous and cute. And then, you know, a few houses down, like there's an abandoned house, right? And so basically what happens is like Camden starts investing heavily in other parts of the community, and that just like is sending all the funding. It's not like that they're without funding, it's like they're also just choosing not to invest in these communities.
Well, you said There's like no upkeep and no law enforcement, like less.
Yeah, so there's like
that as well. So that's fewer gonna
law
also
enforcement. Yeah, it's just, it's so hard because like it's not because of the people who are there, it's because they've been abandoned by their own city officials, right?
I wanted to point out that there's other places like this across the U.S. and they become like these pockets of where people are like not surprised when crime happens there, but then it ends up like putting like almost a bad light on the certain people that are there and trying to like maintain their lives, but they can't because like their house might be beautiful and well-maintained, but the abandoned house two doors down has become like a place of crime that nobody is like regulating or watching out for. So then eventually they're going to sell their house.
Move out.
For almost nothing.
Yep.
Move out. And then that whole street is going to like go down even worse, right? So it's like it goes down to like cities, but also goes down to like these little pockets. Like, and even to a point, like certain streets, like even streets here, you know,
yeah.
Like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's like certain areas where like if somebody's like, oh, a crime happened, we're like, oh, okay.
Okay.
So yeah. It's that kind of thing. But it's not like because the population is any different. It's like those places get forgotten.
And so this all brings us, this is kind of what's happening. You've got these families who are desperately clinging to and trying to hope that this community turns around. They're asking city officials, like, please help our communities. And that's the setting for what happens on April 28th, 1979. We are going to Grant Street in North Camden. So I just mentioned that like there were three blocks that people were like, could you rehabilitate these blocks, right?
So is Grant one of the, like, kind of forgotten streets here?
Yeah, and it's so sad because it's like, you know, this was specifically community members were like, hey, this street, people who live here, we want help, right? So Grant Street itself is like this incredibly narrow street. It's lined by row houses. So row houses are quite typical in this area of North Camden. So you have houses that share exterior walls, and they're occasionally broken up by alleyways or small side yards. On April 28th, 5-year-old Harry Castaner, who lived with his family on Grant Street, found the partially decomposed remains of someone on a porch of a nearby house.
Poor Harry.
Yeah.
That's a lot for a 5-year-old.
Yeah, well, and we only have this detail because in 1991, so well after this, Harry, the same Harry who reportedly found those remains of this woman, was digging in his backyard of the home he shared with his sister, his mother, and his nephews, and he was digging down so he could pour a concrete slab that he planned to put a kiddie pool on for his nephews. And while doing so, he dug up a glass jar with fingers and a thumb inside.
Please tell me they're not from the same person.
They don't think so. Like, I couldn't really actually find out what happened with the glass jar. God,
poor Harry.
Yeah.
This kid is gonna, or man now.
Well, because, well, at the time he would have been, like, in his late teens. He's still a kid.
So he did have 5 and then again in his teens finding human remains?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think initially the assumption was that this glass jar was holding a medical specimen of some sort.
That makes it a bit better. Kind of.
Yeah, so not connected.
I mean, not for Harry at the moment, but it makes it better in just life. That is not, like, who would do that? Like, who would just cut off fingers and put them in a jar? The medical thing at least is, like, a decent explanation.
Right. I mean, I don't know how the story turned out from there, because, again, I couldn't trace where the finger thing went. But while covering this story, Harry talks about the moment he found the woman's body on the porch 12 years before. He said he didn't remember the moment, but that his mother told him that he was really scared and wouldn't stop crying.
That's probably why he can't remember it.
Now, this initial discovery has also been reported differently. So you will also see that you're going to see this throughout this woman's story. The multitude of ways that her story is reported, even though there's few details. It's a little weird to me. So the alternative version is that her remains are found by workmen underneath a porch and that her body had been bound and electrical cords were wrapped around her neck.
Those are two very wildly different stories.
Yes. Is it a little kid? Is it workmen? There's, like, the details.
Is she on a porch? Is she hidden?
Yeah.
Is she bound? Is she not bound? Like,
so vastly different. The next month, there's a brief mention of her in the newspaper. So she's found in April. This article comes out in May. In it, the Camden County prosecutor and the city police were asking the public for assistance in identifying her. In this initial description, they described her as being Hispanic or Black and between the ages of 19 and 20. They said that she was between 5'1 and 5'5 and that she was wearing tan bell-bottom pants, although they used the word slacks. I don't know. Is that a New Jersey thing?
A lot of people say slacks. Do they not?
What? Is it a regional difference, I think? Like pop and soda?
It could be time.
Yeah. My grandmother would have said slacks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they say that she was wearing a top. It was red or maroon. And that she was wearing a thin metal bracelet with a tension closure on her left wrist. And was also wearing bikini underpants. At the time, they didn't list her cause of death. But they did say that it was a homicide.
I was going to ask about the house. Like, do we know whose house it is? And is it one of the abandoned ones or?
Unclear.
Unclear. Okay. We don't know anything. We know nothing. Do we know anything about the house or whose it was?
So we don't. Like, we do know this area is, like, struggling with abandoned housing. Whether or not this was or not, I'm not sure. Don't know. Okay. We just know that it was in the 400 block of Grant Street. Now, if you're like me, you may be wondering how on a narrow street with row houses and front porches that look directly onto other front porches, how it's possible that this would have gone unnoticed. We have to go back to what those community groups were desperately trying to get local officials to recognize. Christine Bosworth, who was a member of one of the groups, said that in her neighborhood of North Camden, there was a significant decrease in law enforcement presence. She said that for 2 years, foot patrols had stopped entirely, and it wasn't until 2 weeks before her interview with a local paper that they'd started up again. And even then, it was only in the afternoons. And to be clear, the entire community was feeling the effects of this, but Grant Street in particular was facing a dramatic increase in crime. The summer before, there'd been an arrest of some men in what was described as a major heroin supply ring, and someone must have snitched on others because it spread to 12 arrests by the time it was done. The initial bust happened at a pool hall on Grant Street. Also, 3 years before that, a man burned down his own home on Grant Street with someone inside purposefully killing him. And then on the 700 block of Grant Street, you have a man who murdered his cousin after the two got into an altercation on their front porch, and the young man's body was later found in an alleyway nearby. So you already have what are some significant and heartbreaking crimes happening already in the years leading up to her body being found, and the community members who are desperately trying to hold on to their neighborhoods. And so that must have been like heartbreaking on so many levels for them because they'd been begging for more police coverage, right?
It's also going to make them feel scared to be in their own homes.
Yes.
Like, you've lived in a spot your whole life. You love where you live. Now you're just watching it, like, slowly, like, drift away into a spot where you're scared to be there.
Yeah. And so, you know, throughout you see these newspaper articles of, like, the people who are trying to enact change and trying to rebuild their communities eventually are so uncomfortable or so under threat that they, too, are moving out, right?
Right. So, like, and I said slowly, but I think this happened actually quite suddenly, right?
Yeah. So, like, you have kind of, like, industries start closing in the 50s and, like, from the 1970s, definitely through the 90s as well, like, just this, like, rapid shift, right? So in their lifetime, they go from these, like, beautiful communities where it's, like, neighbors knowing neighbors to these places where these, like, major crimes are happening. So when we get to her body being found, like, this is already a neighborhood that's under threat, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So this would be an area, like, at that point that had the people in the surrounding areas heard about this, they'd be like, oh, okay, just another crime happening there.
Right. Yeah. So it's just because, you know, again,
Circumstances.
And then, like, also just, like, actual decisions by decision makers to kind of underfund and abandon really this area of the city. Like, if you have people who are like, hey, we used to have foot patrols, we used to know the cops in the area, we used to see them, right, to, like, they're just not there. And at the same time, you also have a city and a county that either can't or won't invest resources. In 1979, the same year this woman's body is found, the Courier Post actually ran an article about unsolved crimes in the area. In Camden County, they listed 10 unsolved murders over the past 5 years. And nearby Burlington County, it had 3 murders where there were no suspects. And the same was happening in Gloucester County, which had an unsolved murder from 1931 on the books. So there's all these unsolved crimes that are happening in the region. And that's not just murders. There were also unsolved disappearances as well. Like Margaret Fox, who was 14 and disappeared when she left home to go on a babysitting interview. You know, Vanessa, before we began, I sat down and I showed you my giant 2025 spreadsheet.
Yes. It was very impressive. I'm not a spreadsheet enthusiast like you are. Mm-hmm. So I probably disappointed you with my reaction.
Well, also, you just can't see the beauty of the spreadsheet on my iPad because on a computer, it's, like, color-coded and there's drop-down menus. And anyway.
So it's much more beautiful than the version I saw.
It is. But Margaret Fox is actually on there. And so when I encountered her name while doing research for this, I was like, oh.
It's Margaret.
Margaret. Right. So we are going to be covering Margaret's disappearance in the future. Anyway, so we're connecting a few things here. We have an unidentified Black woman who's found in an area of North Camden that has already felt like they've been abandoned by officials. And while I'm guessing residents were not surprised that not much was said about her at the time she was found or after. And so this brings us up to November 1990. So a significant amount of time has passed, 11 years later. There's a new development in her story, although I can't find reporting on it until 1991.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
It doesn't. So something happened in 1990, but it wasn't reported until a year later?
Yeah, a few months later, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, a few months, but still.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It takes a while.
That took a while.
For information.
We'll be back in a moment.
So the new development is that in November 1990, men are working on cleaning out a basement of rubble and debris and found her skull.
Whose skull?
The woman's skull.
You said it was a woman's body, but you didn't say it was a woman's body.
Right.
You need to be more specific.
Oh, well, because they were not specific.
So you didn't know. This was a surprise to you as well.
No, I knew because I'm coming at this from someone, you know, in the 2000s in which both pieces of that information are available.
But like at that time, did people only hear the version woman's body but didn't know what that meant?
Well, yeah. So at the time in the 1970s when they initially reported, it was not made clear.
Isn't that a giant detail to leave out?
Yes.
Because like I'm already, if I'm living in this neighborhood, I'm already nervous.
Yes. I'm willing to bet the people in the neighborhood knew.
Okay.
Right? Because we get the official version.
Yeah.
If there's like the community conversations that are happening.
Okay.
But officially, yes, that initial one news article, there is not information that she had been decapitated.
Because that brings it to a much more violent level. I mean, we have like this, we found her on the porch, we found her under the porch bound, and now
we find out this.
Right. So yeah. Like the going from like, oh, she just like, there was a thing that happened and she died to, wow, this was extremely violent.
Yes. So it's a significant detail to gloss over.
A whole head.
Mm-hmm. Now, from Harry's 1991 interview, remember Harry says he's the one who found her in 1979 and then found some fingers in a jar in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
He says that her skull was found on the 400 block of State Street. State Street runs parallel to Grant Street, and it seems that her skull was found in a residence maybe across the alleyway from
a completely different location.
Yes. Now, the fact that she was found by construction workers this time is not at all surprising, nor is the fact that there wasn't much coverage of this discovery. In 1990, the same month that her skull was found, North Camden was reeling from an explosive, quite literally, mischief night. Vanessa, did you ever experience mischief night in Canada?
No, I've never even heard of mischief night before. What is this?
Like, we call it cabbage night.
What? I've been here for like... Do you do a cabbage night?
No, I've never engaged in
cabbage night. I've never heard of mischief night or cabbage night, and I've been living here for like 13 years.
Okay, well, you need to turn on your police scanner on the night before Halloween and just listen in. So very often here, people are leaving burning tires and furniture in the middle of intersections. And one year, like a car got torched.
On cabbage night? The night before Halloween? So, in Canada, on Halloween night, they do, like, the egging and the toilet papering.
Yeah.
Is it like that? But with... Why cabbage?
I don't... Maybe there was cabbage involved originally. I don't know. Although, now that I'm thinking about the car situation, I think that might have happened on St. Platty's Day, which is...
Platty's Day? Are you... What?
Do you not know about St. Platty's Day?
Platty's? Oh, is it... No?
So that happens the weekend before St. Patrick's
Day. Everywhere?
No, just here.
Okay.
Okay, Cabbage Night and Mischief Night are everywhere. St. Platty's Day is specific to where we live.
Okay. And so we light cars on fire for St. Platty's Day?
Not usually, but I think one got lit on
fire. Did we get a little... We got a little...
Yeah.
Overdone there? But
basically what happens... I can't believe Canada is left out of this. I feel like
there is the egging and the toilet papering on Halloween night, which I think is very similar.
But not like setting fires?
No!
Okay. Well.
What?
Camden experienced mischief night. So here mischief night or cabbage night happens the night before. It sounds like in Camden it was happening the night of Halloween.
Okay.
Basically, progressively, year after year, like... It gets worse and worse in Camden. And so North Camden gets hit hard that night. There are 89 arrests in North Camden, and that's largely due to vandalism and fires.
Now the police show up.
Yeah, they actually coordinated for that.
So they knew, so they were getting ready.
Yes. Actually, the following year, 1991, that grows exponentially, and there are at least 14 cars set on fire. There are 3-alarm, 4-alarm, 5-alarm fires throughout the city. And there are some row houses that are torched, Like, there are 80 fires that night in 1991, the following year.
Cabbage night gone wild.
Yes. And so, 1990, right, it's fires are in the news. It's this kind of mischief making. It's the arrests that are in the news. Actually, mischief night is what forces a lot of people to, like, finally just give up. Like, it was, like, the last straw. So in 1990 and 1991, when those things happen, they're just like, I can't anymore. So all of this is happening. There's these fires on Mischief Night in 1990. But prior to then, between 1984 and 1999, there were 60 fires in abandoned buildings owned by the city throughout that time. So the city had basically foreclosed on those homes and taken them over. And that amount doesn't include fires in abandoned buildings not owned by the city.
So the city's taking over buildings and leaving them abandoned, and that's just kind of like perpetuating the problem.
Right. And so residents were like, hey, could you do something about that? Could you board them up? Could you demolish them? Mm-hmm. Can something be done?
Right. Just demolishing them or like trying to like rehabilitate them into some sort of housing.
Yeah. So they said, oh, well, you know, it costs us, I think the quote was like $1,000 to board up a residence and $10,000 to demolish it. And the city basically didn't even want to invest that much. They're like, oh, that's the cost. It's going to take us a while to work on this problem. We acknowledge that there's a problem, but like the funds just aren't there. So you'll have to wait. Hmm. And the community is like, we've been waiting long enough.
Right. Right. Seems like the abandoned places are the places that these problems are happening. So
yeah, so that's what the residents say. Like, they're like, hey, you know, like you're not giving us places for our children to play. Mm-hmm. And so our children end up playing in these abandoned buildings. It's also where dealers are stashing things, right? Which mm-hmm. makes sense because it's an available structure. It's also a place where people who are addicted to substances are going to like hide their addictions and like.
But even just for vandalism and these little fires, like this is the row house, this abandoned one that's going to start your home on fire because somebody goes in there and starts one, you know, like.
Yeah. So because they're all interconnected. Yeah,
they're all so close, to, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a danger.
Right. So basically the residents are like, hey, you know, please help us. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a lot different than like the broken windows policing, which as for clarity is like a system that we've acknowledged like doesn't work. But like, you know, what the residents are saying is like, you know, what we want is our neighborhood to have funding and care. They said the city was spending $52 million on waterfront development while their neighborhoods were falling down around them. And the city was not investing in them. Now, I just have Harry's word that this woman's skull was found on the 400 block of State Street, but that makes sense. The North Camden Land Trust, which was a private nonprofit group, was actually renovating 5 houses into 10 cooperative apartments. Those included 401, 407, and 411 through 415. These were designed to be apartments for low or moderate income individuals, and work began on those houses in November 1990. That lines up with the time frame the woman's skull was found. This section of housing was once known as Lawyers Row and was described as former mansions. So the successful renovation of these buildings into apartments was likely seen as a critical step forward in creating change for this area of North Camden. And that brings me back to this woman. Despite her skull having been found in November 1990, once again, there is not, from my research, immediate news coverage of this. A news story doesn't appear until the following year, March 26, 1991. This is when the Camden County prosecutor brings reporters into his office to reveal a clay reconstruction of the woman's face. At this event, we learn that yes, her body had been found decapitated in 1979 and that her skull was found in November 1990. This is also where we learn that her body parts were found in separate residences across a common alley. The prosecutor revealed that the medical examiner estimated that she had been dead for 6 months by the time her torso was found. So this would have placed her time of death somewhere around November 1978.
That makes the porch thing not seem to make sense unless someone put her there after.
Yeah, so
the under the porch makes a little more sense in this case.
Right. But then, like, how does Harry
come in? It's all very confusing.
It is.
But Harry himself doesn't have a recollection either from trauma or because maybe he wasn't the one who found it.
I don't know. So he just has his mom said.
Okay.
He had, right? But in this meeting with reporters, they state that it's assumed that this woman was between the ages of 17 and 20, and they had placed her at 5 feet 3 inches tall. Her skull had been turned over to Donna Fontana, who was a forensic anthropologist at the New York Medical Examiner's Office. She used the skull and clay to reconstruct the woman's head. Because they lacked information on her skin tone and her hairstyle, Fontana decided to depict her as a light-skinned black woman and gave her what they described as a mid-length afro. Now, Vanessa, I usually try to keep episode information to myself, but I did post the newspaper image of this reconstruction to my Facebook, and you saw it. What are your thoughts on it?
I think effort was put in, but like a lot of other reconstructions we've seen, it didn't look like any human I've ever seen.
Yeah, there's always something like weird to me about those.
There is.
Yeah.
It's like, it's like the idea of what you think a human would look like if you've never seen a human before.
Right. Right. I mean, the other thing is, like, I can see the humanness of it personally, but, like, not, she does not read to me as, like, a 17 to 20-year-old.
No, but also, have you ever, like, we see a lot of faces and yes, a lot of different faces, but I've never seen a face like that.
That's true. Good. Solid point, right? Now, during this session with reporters, they also displayed her clothing. Her bell bottoms were there. They were a dark brown in a size 7, and there was a Sears label on them. They also had her top there. Now, this has been described as both a bathing suit and a bodysuit by the brand Jacques Moret. I'm going to go with bodysuit over bathing suit just because she was also wearing underwear. Or there's another option, which is Jacques Moret still exists as the Moret Group, and they own things like Danskin and Jockey, and they do make leotards today, so I'll throw that in as an option as well. Now, this top, be it a bathing suit, a bodysuit, or a leotard, is described as being orange in color. You'll remember they described it earlier as maroon or red, so this is a change in description again.
There's no photos of this bodysuit?
I've not seen photos of the bodysuit.
So no one will ever know the color.
Yeah, is it maroon? Is it red? Is it orange?
Right, maroon to orange is kind of a jump.
Yeah, so in her NamUs profile, it says orange, but the initial report said maroon or red. So, you know, if we go by the NamUs profile, we would say orange.
The most accurate.
But I'm just opening it up to the possibility, you know, if anyone's trying to remember encountering this woman, like maybe maroon, maybe red, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe, like, is it a leotard? Was she a dancer? Is it a bathing suit? Was she, you know, out bathing, swimming somewhere before? Now, if you're wondering how can they conclusively link her body to the skull that was found, they said the medical investigator said that the body parts matched. And I don't know what that means. And it's not clear to me that they've done any more work to compare the two to confirm.
Okay, so it wasn't confirmed by anything other than we have a body without a head. We have a head without a body. Maybe the ages, roughly, or skin color.
Well, so I'm not
But not sure. Even because the skull would not have any.
Yeah, because it's been quite a while.
Marking.
So there must be some reason they felt that they were a match. I mean, they were found in two buildings across an alleyway from one another. So
proximity.
Proximity, maybe there's some sort of markings on the bones that kind of match up through the decapitation thing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like, it's hard to believe this was in like the late 70s throughout the 90s, because this is like, we are not keeping track of anything in a way that you think anyone in remotely modern times would keep track of anything.
Yeah.
This seems like this could have happened in the 1800s and we would know just as much information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, you know, some of those cases we know more about.
More, yeah.
And so in 1991, there's this release of information, but from there, like, things seem to really stall out and the march of time really has not been kind, and I think decreases the likelihood that, you know, of her identification. Now, I said that there were a lot of inconsistencies.
Yeah.
For one, they have at this point misplaced or lost her skull reconstruction. And again, though I do question how accurate this was in the first place, it's not included in her online profile. So for instance, it's not on her NamUs page or on the Doe Network. We do have the images from the day the reconstruction was shown to the public. So we will share those out on our social pages.
But even if it isn't accurate, somebody put a lot of work into making that. Shouldn't it still be there in some form?
Well, so from what I've read and know in conversations that I've had, like, sometimes it's not even necessarily the accuracy, but just like a visual cue for people. Like people will stop on cases where there's some sort of image associated with it. So
right, but it's just like when somebody goes through that work, you think we'd have some care for that, like too, like the
yeah.
respect for the effort that was put in and not just lose
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So even I think, you know, her profile would be more complete even just having the newspaper image of the photo
right.
of the reconstruction. And then maybe that would help. I mean, I don't think anyone would look at it and be like, oh, that's so-and-so. But I think someone would stop to look at it and maybe read a little
bit about it. Just like the attention-grabbing part of it. Yeah.
So the other things are that, you know, in looking for information about her, for instance, the Doe Network includes the information that she had been stabbed 8 times. This is not in her NamUs profile, and I was not able to independently verify that that's true. The Doe Network also includes that she may have been homeless and from the Delaware Valley area, but again, I was not able to independently confirm this information or why that information was included. One of the other interesting things I found is that the Doe Network also includes that part of her body was found in Newark, which I've always thought, like, that's the information I was working on. But Newark is a good 2 hours, I believe, away from Camden. And looking at the newspaper articles, you know, about this, like, from what I know, that information seems to be wrong and that she was found both times, at least, in North Camden.
Was there other parts?
No. So they're saying part of her was found.
Okay.
One of those parts was found in Newark. But, you know, from what I can tell, the information is that she was found just in North Camden. Added to that, it states that her date of death is January 1st, 1979. Now, often January 1st is used as kind of like a placeholder date, but we do know from that early article, they were estimating her date of death as happening 6 months before of her being found in April, which places it in or about November 1978 that she was murdered. And that can be really important when people are considering when they last saw someone or interacted or seen something. So the date could go back even further than what's listed online. You know, I always wonder, what are the chances of identifying someone? What are they? But this is not a case that gives me much hope. We have a woman who at the very discovery of wasn't covered widely in news outlets. And she was really overshadowed by these other community concerns and needs. And there's been such little interest in her case that I hope that our podcast is our own way of shining light on her case and saying that she mattered. And saying that someone out there is missing her, and maybe this could be a chance for someone to put some pieces together in terms of identifying her.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Blood Relics, read by Shay Mack. Classically trained, Shay is an actress, director, and acting coach based in Atlanta, Georgia. She received a BA in theater from Spelman College. Shay is a recurring actress in DC Comics' Doom Patrol. She can also be seen in Ozark, Tell Me Your Secrets, and more. Although she has directed numerous theatrical productions over the years, she made her film and television directorial debut directing the multi-award-winning short, The Virtual Babysitter, as well as the upcoming season one series, Welcome to the 40s. She also coaches and self-tapes actors from all over the world with her company, Audition with Shay Mack.
Blood Relics. Unidentified woman discovered April 28, 1979 in Newark, New Jersey, and November 1990 in North Camden, New Jersey. Come to this desperate place where my bones have been separate for so long the notch grooves don't fit. You need alignment to answer why your skull is found beneath the broken wood of a house where strong men flex dark muscles beneath November's worn out sun. You will find the call of your body is not one of desire, where the splintered ache in your chest is simply the curl of a caterpillar taking root in the hole where your heart once was. I thought I knew how a butterfly becomes something other than a tongue lost in words, but it is not how wings grow from flesh. It is how we are reduced to liquid in whom we might have kissed under the whispers of this tree while singing the night awake.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.